This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Chicago attorney Michael Deutsch about the recent victory in the Mohamed Salah case.
The jury did the right thing. Michael Deutsch, of course, is a fine criminal defense lawyer. He used to be the director of litigation at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I moved out to Chicago, caught this major case.
We'll also speak with attorney Bob Bloom about the recent arrests of Black Panthers, stemming back 35 years.
Another stellar criminal defense attorney. Bloom was famous for his defense of the Panthers here in New York, moved out to the coast 15 years ago, and he's keeping up the job.
We'll hear from attorney Len Weinglass with an update on the case of the Cuban Five.
A third great defense attorney, now representing the government of Cuba in their attempt to get the frame-up of the Cuban Five lifted.
We'll examine an alternative view on former President Jimmy Carter's recent book.
ACLU attorney Jamil Dakwar grew up in Israel, is practicing law here in New York, and talks about his experience over there.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
In a blow to the court-martial trial of Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara, last week the military judge ruled that almost all defense witnesses would not be allowed to take the stand. Earlier, the judge had ruled that Ouattara's attorney, Eric Seitz, would not be able to bring up the legality of the war in Iraq. Seitz had planned to call several international and constitutional law experts, including our own Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and another of our frequent guests, Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild. Ouattara had refused to deploy to Iraq because he said the war is wrong. He's charged with conduct unbecoming an officer, contempt, and missing a troop movement. He said he is not opposed to all war and would be willing to serve in Afghanistan, and said that the Army refused his request for reassignment. Ouattara says his obligation is to the Constitution and not to what he regards as illegal orders. He could be sentenced to 6 years in a military prison and a dishonorable discharge. Ouattara is the first objector since 1965 to be prosecuted by the military. Michael, can you believe it's been nearly 6 months since we interviewed freelance videographer Josh Wolf, as he was literally on his way to prison?
He was walking down the street talking to us on a cell phone about to be incarcerated again, and he's still in.
Well, he actually surpassed the U.S. record for the most time spent in jail by a journalist for refusing to comply with a grand jury subpoena, over 170 days in jail.
Yeah, and what did he do? He videotaped a demonstration where a police car was burned.
Allegedly was burned. Yeah. We're not sure about those details. It was at the G8 summit protest in San Francisco, July 2005. Now, Wolf and his many supporters claim the attempted car arson is just a pretext for a fishing expedition about protesters and also about chilling independent news gatherers.
Well, absolutely. They recruit, in a sense, these news gatherers to be arms of the police department. They turn the independent media into the eyes and the ears of a repressive police state. And Josh is standing up for the First Amendment, and he's doing it at tremendous personal sacrifice, 6 months in prison.
Yeah, and there's no federal shield law that protects journalists from federal grand jury demands.
No, there are in some states, but not a federal
one. Oh, not federal, right. And as you say, this case has raised questions about who is and who isn't a journalist. Sort of delineations between professional and amateur reporters are blurred, especially as in this case when objectivity is at issue. Here, Wolf clearly supported the protesters about whom he was reporting.
Detachment and objectivity are two different things. Was he detached? Obviously not. Are you Heidi or am I? No, we're not. Our listeners certainly know the point of views that we have, but we try to be objective. It's a different thing.
Well, we send our best to Josh and support the courageous convictions that are keeping him inside.
Absolutely.
For more than a year, Law and Disorder has followed the case of Muhammad Salah and co-defendant Abdelhalim Ashkar. In a major victory, both were recently acquitted on charges that they engaged in a racketeering conspiracy to provide support to the Palestinian organization Hamas in the early 90s. The two were convicted of several lesser charges unrelated to terrorism. Salah says his confession to Israeli security agents was false and the end product of 53 days in custody, during which time Salah's lawyers say he was tortured. He was kept awake, beaten, and forced to sit in excruciating positions for long periods of time. Today we talk with Salah's attorney, Michael Deutsch, from the People's Law Office in Detroit. Deutsch says this verdict is a significant breakthrough, in that the jurors were not swayed by government attempts to apply the terrorism label without adequate evidence.
Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
A huge congratulations from all of us, Michael.
Wonderful.
We've followed this case. This is the third time you've been on. Mm-hmm. This, I think, is the most significant victory in defense of civil liberties and human rights that we've had since Bush and company started going after Muslims with their fear and hate campaign. You stood up in Chicago. They got this fellow that hadn't done anything, he said, except go over to Palestine with money for charity. They accused him of being part of the inner sanctum of Hamas, giving money for terror there, probably being part of a terrorist cell here in the United States. It was all this fear that went on there. The trial lasted over several months. The jury was out for more than 2 weeks. This is a major defeat for the United States government, for Ashcroft, Attorney General Ashcroft, who brought this thing initially at a press conference. You, Michael Deutsch, and your law firm, the People's Law Office, that stood up and beat back the government. So for all of us here on Law and Disorder, our heartiest congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I want to just mention the names of Erica Thompson and Ben Elson from my office, who were very instrumental in helping us assure this victory. And it was indeed a great victory because originally, as you mentioned, there was a huge press conference by then Attorney General Ashcroft claiming that they had arrested a sleeper cell in the United States of Palestinian terrorists. You know, this was going to make us safe from terrorism, and this was right on the eve of the 2004 presidential election. It was clearly politically motivated to create a buzz among the Jewish community and others about their making us safe for terrorism. And initially, Mr. Salah was charged with a RICO conspiracy, being part of a military commander in Hamas, that he also was charged with providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization, Hamas, and of obstructing justice by lying on answers to civil interrogatories in a civil case brought by the Israeli lobby. And as you said, at the end of a three-month trial and 2 weeks of deliberation, the jury pretty much rejected the government's entire case. They did convict him of the minor charge of obstruction of justice, lying in his interrogatory answers. But as far as the RICO charge, he was acquitted, as was his co-defendant, Dr. Abdelhalim Ashkar. And the material support charge was dismissed on the eve of trial, right before we started trial, because it was based on the lies of an informant that had been working with the FBI for 7 years, who was telling fantastic stories that the government couldn't even stand behind. And they had to disregard that charge. Essentially, in order to acquit on the racketeering charge, they had to reject the confession. They had to believe that it was the product of torture. They had to reject the idea that Hamas was a racketeering organization like the mafia or a Colombian drug cartel. And they had to somehow believe that it was wrong for the United States to criminalize the people who were the victims of a brutal and terrible occupation by the Israeli government, which had been going on since 1948 and 1967 in terms of a military occupation of the Gaza and the West Bank. And the thing that was so important in this case is we were able to put before the jury, both in cross-examination and in our own case, the true story of what's going on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, starting from the partition in 1948 and how the Israeli military drove over a million people from their homes, and going right up to the Intifada in 87 and the second Intifada, and to explain to the jury that these are people who are fighting for their very existence and resisting a genocidal occupation. And as a result of that, I think the jury could understand that it wasn't right to go back to 1993 and use that kind of evidence obtained by the Israeli secret police in a U.S. courtroom. Of course, they were observed the fact that our cross-examination was limited of these interrogators who came to testify, and that at times the courtroom was closed, and that we asked the jury in both the opening and closing that they didn't have to accept a case based on torture, and this was a significant case that said what kind of country we are, what kind of people we are, what our criminal justice is really about, and if we're going to accept torture, this is a very serious step in the wrong direction.
Now, Michael, tell us a bit about the composition of the jury, and were you surprised at their decision?
We had a very good jury. It was made up of 7 African-American people, an Hispanic man, and a civil rights lawyer who was white, and 3 other white people. So we started out thinking we had a jury that would be open-minded and listen to our case. They wouldn't be closed. They wouldn't think, oh, this is about terrorism. We have to support the government no matter what.
So I thought, Michael, not only open-minded, but wouldn't be freaked out by the notion of a Muslim. I remember the Nation of Islam was founded in Chicago, the first mosque.
Exactly.
The whole fear campaign that Ashcroft and the rest of them tried to stir up in this country, this kind of anti-Muslim fanaticism, I don't think it played as well amongst a black jury in Chicago than, say, it would have in Toledo.
Absolutely. I think that's right. And I also think that we were able to kind of seize the field in the courtroom. Both defendants were out on bail, and that was really important because you didn't have that heavy influx of marshals in the courtroom guarding them. In fact, we had many sidebars during the case, and at each sidebar, the defendants would be part of the group of lawyers that were up there with the judge. And no, there was no marshal standing behind them. There was no heavy security inside the courtroom. Of course, outside the courtroom there was. There was an atmosphere of that we were in charge, and this was aided extensively by the fact that almost every day of the trial, the courtroom was packed with people from supporters and a lot of people from the mosque that Mr. Salah comes from, young people and all kinds of people, so that the jury could see that there was a courtroom full of our supporters and not a courtroom full of government supporters.
We're talking with Attorney Michael Deutsch, fresh from a stunning victory against the United States government in the Mohammed Salah case. Judith Miller, the now defunct reporter for the New York Times, the woman that helped sell the war against Iraq, was one of the star witnesses for the U.S. government against your client. What was she doing there?
Well, very strangely, she was allowed into the secret interrogation center where Mr. Salah was being interrogated. Probably about the 18th day of his interrogation, the U.S. was not buying the fact that he was a Hamas commander or that Hamas was calling the shots from the U.S. Yitzhak Rabin, then prime minister, personally invited her into to view a small portion of the interrogation, less than an hour, which she viewed on closed-circuit television, so then she could write an article, which she ultimately did on the front page of the New York Times, saying that Mr. Salah wasn't being tortured and that he was a Hamas military commander and that she had observed this. It turns out that she doesn't speak any Arabic. The whole interrogation was in Arabic. She said she had a tape recorder there, and then when she got on the witness stand, she said she forgot. She doesn't know if she had a tape recorder. There was no tape produced. But one of the things she said that was so interesting was that when the Israelis first contacted her and showed her some documents and this map, she didn't believe it. She thought it could be forgeries. and she didn't trust the Israelis. Of course, this was just a cover story. Therefore, she demanded to see Mr. Salah before she would write a story. And see, what was going on at this point, 1993, is the Israelis were trying to convince the U.S. to stop money coming from the Palestinian communities in the U.S. for people suffering under occupation. And the U.S. was saying, well, people have the First Amendment right to do that. We're not going to stop it. And they're saying, oh, it's going for terrorism. This is Hamas. And the U.S. was very skeptical of that. So they were using Salah as some kind of way to convince the U.S. that money was coming to fund terrorism, and it was coming from Hamas. And that's where Judith Miller comes in, because she was a close friend of Yitzhak Rabin. She admitted that she knew him for 25 years, that they would see each other socially. And she was going to be the vehicle to convince the FBI, they admitted this in the trial, to convince the FBI that money was coming for terrorism from the U.S. Obviously, they didn't believe Judith Miller. They didn't believe the 5 hours of taped confession. They didn't believe the handwritten statement that was 54 pages. They rejected the sense that they could rely on evidence that was created and obtained by the Israeli secret police. And I think that is a big victory to just discredit what Israel has been doing and has done against the Palestinian people.
Now, Michael, when the verdict came in, how did the government react?
Well, they were shocked and livid. And, of course, we immediately started celebrating and said it was a huge victory. And then they had a press conference and said, oh, it's not a victory. We convicted him, because they convicted both defendants of obstruction. And they were saying, oh, this is not going to deter us from continuing to prosecute people who are involved with terrorism.
Yes, it is. This is
but
a real.
I think it's a big signal to them that, you know, people are not going to accept the fact that they can criminalize people resisting occupation in a U.S. courtroom. They're just not going to do it. Jurors, if you have an opportunity to educate them and to explain to them the whole history and the suffering that's gone on among the Palestinian people, I think they are sympathetic. But unfortunately, in this country, we don't get the information. So if you have a captive audience, a 3-month trial, and a judge that's willing to let you put that evidence in, then you have an ability to influence a jury of open-minded people.
Yeah, that's what we call a political trial.
Yeah.
And that's why we so value attorneys like you, Michael Deutsch, because you know how to lay it out. In the interest of full disclosure here, my nephew Ben Elson works in your firm.
Yeah, and he was very helpful in our trial.
And he told me the scene after the victory was just amazing, particularly when Mohamed Salah went down and faced the press for the first time. Tell us what that was like.
Well, first of all, there was a huge amount of press there, and Mr. Salah came down with his 8-year-old son on his shoulders. And he spoke to the press, thanked all his community and his people for sacrificing for him.
And then I heard that he said, I am not a terrorist.
Right.
And then he said that if he does get sentenced to some kind of community service for the putting the wrong answer on a written interrogatory, probably at his other attorney's advice, but in any case, if he had to do community service, I heard he said he'd like to do something in the Jewish community.
Yeah, he said he would be willing to do that, to help Jewish people who are, you know, need that financial or, you know, community support. Yeah, he's a very loving man, a very open-minded man, and the government, you know, should be ashamed of what they put him through. And it's still not done. Believe me, they're going to try and ask for 10 years on this obstruction count.
Vis-a-vis the sentencing, is there anything that our listeners can do, send letters?
Yes.
We'll put it up on our website, but give us the address so that our listeners can get a pen.
The letter should be sent to me, Michael Deutsch, People's Law Office, 1180 North Milwaukee, Chicago 60622. The letter should be made out to the Honorable Amy J. St. Eve. St. Eve is her name. And she's the judge, and the sentencing is not till June 15th, so there's plenty of time, but people should send the copies of the letters to me, and then I will submit them with all the other material that we're going to submit for the sentence.
Okay, Michael, we'll put that up on our website.
Okay.
Michael, thank you so much, and most of all, congratulations.
You know, as Michael said, I've been on, this is the third time I'm on, and I'm very happy to share what's a victory for all of us with all of you.
Our solidarity, Michael. You take it easy.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye. Coerced confessions based on torture are at the center of many cases discussed here on the program. From French revolutionary Henri Allègue to the recent victory in the Mohamed Salah case in Chicago. The Black Panthers were no exception. In the early 70s, 8 former Black Panthers were arrested in California, New York, and Florida on charges related to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer. 2 men charged have been held as political prisoners for over 30 years. Herman Bell and Jalil Muntakim are both in New York State prisons. But a judge tossed out the charges, finding that Taylor and his 2 co-defendants made confessions after police in New Orleans tortured them for several days, employing electric shock, cattle prods, beatings, sensory deprivation, plastic bags, and hot, wet blankets for asphyxiation. Joining us now is attorney Bob Bloom to fill us in on new developments in this case.
Bob Bloom, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be here.
Bob Bloom is one of the preeminent criminal defense lawyers, first in New York and now out in California, so we've got a bi-coastal great attorney as our guest.
We'd like to talk about the recent development in this 30-year-old case, but could you give our listeners a brief synopsis of what happened back then?
Sure. Actually, it's a 35-year-old case. What happened was, of course, that J. Edgar Hoover was doing whatever he could to destroy the Black Panther Party.
So bring us fast forward. Bring us up to date. There's been this arrest of these various now people in their 60s who had been active with the Panthers years ago. And what's going on?
Well, to try to be objective about it, a police officer was killed, and law enforcement has every right to try to find the perpetrator. What happened here is way back in the year 1973, several members of the Black Panther Party found themselves in New Orleans, where they were arrested and tortured beyond belief, tortured just as people in Abu Ghraib are tortured, tortured just like the Saudis torture people, tortured like the Israelis torture people, and they got one particular guy, a guy named Reuben Scott, to tell them whatever it was they told them to say. And what they wanted to believe was that this killing had been done by members of the Black Liberation Army in San Francisco. So they got him to say that. They wound up prosecuting him, even though he'd become a government witness, and a judge in San Francisco many years ago threw out the conviction because it was the product of coercion, and they were unable to prosecute anybody. That's the general background.
The men who were recently arrested, had they been tried over 30 years ago?
No, they had not been.
Was there actual physical evidence uncovered that linked them to the killing?
That's another question. The government is claiming that they have enhanced technology. They're able to get a fingerprint off a cigarette lighter, and they're able to do some analysis of shotgun shells that they couldn't do. It appears that that's not true. It appears that that's just made up.
Are they using the same person, Scott, who confessed under torture this time around?
It's unclear, but that's the way it appears.
Did you have any kind of involvement with these people in the years since the initial incident, Bob?
Well, yes, very much so. What happened was there were some prosecutions in New York that were involving the killing of 2 police officers and several police officers, actually. I was involved in those trials, and some of the same people who are accused in San Francisco today were involved in the cases that I participated in.
Will you be representing any of those arrested recently?
It's unclear. Maybe. There are 3 of the people, of the 9 who were arrested, 3 of them were former clients. And I know the others, wonderful people. I mean, it's people, as you say, just living their lives and
have the shock happen, really.
Oh, it's stunning. Before you go to work, they come and talk to you about arrest you for something that happened 35 years previous. Amazing.
I imagine it will be difficult to mount a fair defense given the years that have passed. For example, lack of witnesses, memory fades, hard to disprove this new, I guess, DNA scientific evidence. Is that going to be a problem?
It's going to be a problem. The most immediate problem that comes to mind is the word alibi means, essentially, I was somewhere else and couldn't have committed the crime. But how can you prove where you were on a particular day at a particular time 35 years ago. It's hard enough to think back 35 days to prove where you were. So that's one issue. And the other is, there are other witnesses who could prove that you weren't there. They're likely to be missing, deceased, or whatever. So that's a real problem.
That problem is recognized throughout the criminal law, and that's why we have a statute of limitations, that after a certain amount of time, you can't prosecute people. The only exception is in murder, where there is no statute of limitations.
That's right. Now, the principle is the same, and you would think, yes, of course, murder is the most serious crime. Something to account for the fact that murder is a serious crime, but as you just said, the issues are the same. How can you possibly defend yourself from something so long ago? It's just, you both raised the question, and it's a legitimate question. It isn't like a paper crime where you're going to have records. It isn't a white-collar crime. No way you can reasonably defend yourself from charges that go back that far.
And with all the government's resources and the negativity that many people in law enforcement place on the Black Panthers, and it's highly politicized, do you think there will be a strong showing of support among activists and other concerned individuals?
Well, it's been an amazing display of support. What happened was about a week and a half ago, there was a film that was made about the torture that took place in New Orleans, and it was screened, premiered at a movie theater in San Francisco, which is a kind of a small theater, but it was packed. When I say small, there were about 300 or 400 people there, and there were two showings. They're already, people are turning out, they're appalled at what's going on here. What's going on here is they've created an atmosphere after September 11th of 2001 that's anything the police want, anything law enforcement wants, we'll do, we'll listen to, we'll accept, anything in the name of security. They've scared the hell out of the population, and I think they can parlay that into getting somebody convicted for this crime.
Bob, it's been an honor having you on, and we hope to talk with you again in the future about other cases.
Keep up your wonderful work. This is a great show.
Thank you.
Keep doing it, and keep doing all the good stuff you all do.
Thanks, Bob. Take it easy.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
To hear the voices of the three Black Panthers who were tortured, Harold Taylor, John Bauman, and Hank Jones, visit lawanddisorder.org. Click on the listening library and scroll down. Hear the event from March 2006 at the Riverside Church, sponsored by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Over the past month, several legal developments have occurred in the case of the Cuban Five. In January, the defense argued four key issues in its supplemental brief. Those issues are, 1. The conspiracy to commit murder charge should have been discharged. 2. The conspiracy to espionage should be reversed for insufficiency of evidence. 3. Sentencing on the espionage charges were grossly out of line with existing law. And finally, the prosecution committed misconduct. Also, application of the Classified Information Procedures Act provisions was wrong in this case. Here's the situation. If the two judges can't agree, the chief judge of the 11th Circuit appoints a third judge to join in the decision-making. You must have two judges in agreement in order to have a valid decision by the appellate court. If these two judges agree, however, that's the end of it. Law and Disorder caught up with Leonard Weinglass, lawyer for Antonio Guerrero, to talk about yet an additional aspect that has plagued the case since the five were incarcerated, the U.S. government's failure to allow families to visit the five.
Welcome, Lenny Wineglass, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Len, we've had you on before, but could you please provide a brief background for our listeners about the Cuban Five before we talk about Rene and Gerardo?
Yes, the Cuban Five are five Cuban men who were prosecuted in Miami in 1998 through 2000 and were charged with conspiracy, the usual political charge, conspiracy to commit espionage, and one of them conspiracy to commit murder, relating to their coming to the United States from Cuba in the 1990s after the Cubans had tried unsuccessfully to get the United States and the FBI in particular to begin a process of deterring the attacks that were coming onto Cuba after Cuba began a tourism industry as a way to recover from the fall of the Eastern European socialist countries. They came to the United States. They were unarmed. They infiltrated the mercenary groups that were operating out of southern Florida. They committed no acts of sabotage or violence. No one was injured. They were monitoring and reporting back to Cuba and the activities of these groups. The FBI then began to survey them. After the Cubans provided the FBI with the information that they had developed, photographs and tape recordings, because these groups were operating openly out of camps in southern Florida, and the FBI caught up with the five, arrested them, and prosecuted them. Three of them are doing life. One of them is doing a double life, and the other two are doing 20 years and 17 years, respectively.
Can you tell us a little bit about the two men, Rene and Gerardo?
Yes, Rene Gonzalez and Gerardo Hernandez are two of the five. One is in Florida, Rene. Gerardo is in California. They have been denied, since their arrest in 1998, visits from their wives. It's now over 8 years, going on to 9 years. And this denial of a visitation is clearly a form of torture, and it is expressly against international norms. Amnesty International has spoken to this, as has the European Parliament. And it's also a violation of, I believe, U.S. constitutional law. About 2 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States had occasion to decide a case out of Michigan in which family members, cousins, nieces, and nephews under the age of 12 were denied the right to visit inmates in the state prison in Michigan. A lawsuit followed, and the United States Supreme Court said that the prison authorities could, undermanned as they were, deny the rights of young people who were more distantly related, such as cousins, nieces, and nephews, the right to visit their uncles or their cousins. However, in that decision, the Supreme Court also made it clear that the same rule would not apply to immediate members of the family, such as spouses and children. But it's being applied in this case against Gerardo and Rene. So it's not just a violation of international law. It's a violation of our domestic law and even our constitutional law.
Lenny, can you give us some context in which they're being denied this visitation?
Well, the context is this. It started out with Rene. Rene's wife was here, Olga, with him when he was arrested. She ultimately was taken into custody as well. She was then told that if he would turn state's evidence and testify for the prosecution, that she would be released and able to visit with him and remain in the United States. By the way, another defendant who was arrested did turn state's evidence, and his wife was allowed to remain, and she became a legal resident of the United States, and her husband was released from prison after serving, I think, less than a year. So Rene and his wife, Olga, were offered the same deal. They rejected it. Olga was then deported from the United States, and as a punitive measure, she's been not allowed to come back to see her husband.
Len, when last you were on the show, you had won a tremendous victory in the lower federal court showing that the jury selection process was prejudiced, that the jury could not have given these men a fair trial. And then the government appealed that, and it was turned around. Can you give us an update on the status of the case now in the courts?
Yes. After the district court victory, which you mentioned, the government appealed to the entire court in the 11th Circuit. The court took the case and decided on August the 9th, 2006, that it would reverse the decision by the panel and affirm the convictions of the five. The case was then remanded back to that panel to consider the remaining nine issues that were undecided in the appeal. And we are now before that panel. That panel has called for supplementary briefs, which we filed, and the government answered on December 20th. We then replied to the government's answer, and we're now awaiting a decision of the panel. The panel, which is a panel of three judges of the 11th Circuit, has been reduced to a two-judge panel because one of the three judges retired.
Len, a couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to meet with the families of the five in Cuba and just could not believe how this failure to allow families to visit has an impact on the entire nation of Cuba. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes. It's a country, first of all, that affirms very much the value of the family. And culturally, the families are very close. It's unheard of that any government would take steps to violate the closeness of the family unit. Even the hard right and the anti-Cuban groups that are in the exile community acknowledge that those people who are in custody in Cuba have always had the right to see their family. That claim has never been raised, although many scurrilous claims are raised against Cuba. That one has never been raised. So you're violating a very basic norm of Cuban culture when you take official steps to deny the rights of a family to maintain its unity. I might also say that when you look at the regulations of the United States Federal Bureau of Prisons, those regulations very clearly state that the prison authorities are not permitted to take any steps that will separate the family. And they do that for reasons of self-interest. They know that if the family maintains its integrity while an inmate is serving time, it contributes to the peace and stability of the prison itself as an institution. They bend over backwards not to separate the inmate from his or her family. This is, to our knowledge, the only instance where families have been denied, immediate families, wives and children, denied the right to see an inmate who's in custody.
On what basis are they denying the visa?
The government uses post 9/11 doctrine that for reasons of national security, they are being denied visas. And they don't go into any more detail than that. Adriana, who is the wife of Gerardo, has never been in the United States. She is not an agent or employee of the government of Cuba. She is a resident. And there is absolutely nothing in her background or history that would give them any justification for denying her entry. Olga has been in the United States. But when she was in the United States, she was a housewife and a mother, and she was not involved in any activity whatsoever respecting the United States. And the government has made no such claim. If she had been, she would have been prosecuted.
What international laws and standards prohibit the United States from taking these kinds of actions?
Denying the right to see a family member when you're in custody is considered a form of torture. the United States is a signatory to the Convention Against Torture. I believe there have been cases in Europe where the European Court has decided that to deny an inmate the right to see the immediate family is a form of torture. And that then becomes doctrine in international law. It's a part of the convention now interpreted by a court, and it's what the United States is violating as a signatory to that convention.
And I think the Amnesty International has identified several other international legal standards under which we think this is a violation. For example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Human Rights Committee's General Comments, and the UN Body of Principles for Protection of All Persons under any form of detention or imprisonment also seem to prohibit this type of behavior from the United States. What we're doing is we're asking all individuals who don't support this and find the United States' actions reprehensible to take action and to write letters to Director Stephen McFarland at the Office of Cuban Affairs. We'll put that address up on the website, and there'll be a link to it. You can find out more information. We'll put it on our Amnesty website, amnestyusa.org/US.
Len, what are the mental states of Renee and Gerardo as a result of this denial of visitation?
Well, I must say both of them are very strong, strong-willed, courageous men. I believe Gerardo has served in Angola in a mission to defeat the South African army, which led to the end of apartheid. He has a long history of being a person who has worked to protect the revolution, and he's a strong individual. Renee is the same. Renee is rather heroic, the way he came to the United States and his work in the United States. He, of all of them, he was really exposed. If he had been found out by the groups he was had infiltrated, his life would have been in jeopardy. So these are two strong, principled people, but they are human beings after all. They miss their families. They would love to see their wives. Renee has never seen an infant daughter that was born after he was put in custody. And so these are real personal tragedies on a very human level. It's totally unnecessary to deny them the right to see their families.
How old are they?
I would say that they are both in their 40s. Maybe Gerardo is closer to being in 50, but they're both in excellent physical condition, and I'm not a good judge of age, but I would put them at that age.
Thank you so much for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, Len Wineglass. We've been following this case. Listeners who want to hear your past interviews can go to lawanddisorder.org. Thanks again. We wish you the best of luck.
Right.
Bye, Len.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Len.
Bye-bye.
So long.
Okay.
With the release of Jimmy Carter's newest book, Peace, Not Apartheid, there's been a great deal of controversy over his use of the word apartheid to describe the occupied Palestinian territories. He starts from a premise. Inside of Israel, there is equality, while in the occupied Palestinian territories, there is not. And today we want to discuss the myth that there is equality inside of Israel. With us to discuss this, we have Jamil Dakwar, formerly a senior lawyer with Adela, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, where he argued several cases in front of the Israeli High Court. We're really pleased to have him back with us today on Law and Disorder to discuss this issue. Jamil Dakwar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So recently you wrote an article about the rights and the treatment of Arab Israelis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what drove me to write this this article, which appeared in the Ahram Weekly, was the fact that the discussion about the newly released Carter book focused on Israeli practices and policies in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the West Bank and Gaza, and has less focused on the situation inside Israel. In fact, I heard President Carter speaking on several media interviews, including one on NBC, who said, and I want to quote, when he was asked about his book, he said, "I'm not referring to the treatment of Arabs who are living in Israel and who are citizens of Israel and have full citizenship rights to vote and so forth." Again, and he continues, "The apartheid that is perpetrated now on the Palestinians in the occupied territory is not based on racism." So I thought in this very quickly to just to challenge this notion that, first of all, it's not about racism, and arguing that many of the practices and policies that Israel is practicing in the occupied territories are actually racially driven, including policies since Israel's establishment of 1948 with land and housing policies, with segregating villages, Arab towns, and so forth, and as well as saying that people inside, Palestinians who live inside Israel, and they have 20% of them, more maybe connect with defining Israel as not a democracy, but rather closer to some kind of a form of apartheid.
Tell us what life is like for Palestinian Israelis.
Yes, I was born in Haifa, which is not the place where you'll probably see all the bad things about the bad situation of the Palestinians inside Israel. It's although the Arab neighborhoods are pretty much segregated, and there are no kind of many mixed neighborhoods in Haifa itself, and you could see the differences and inequality between the neighborhoods, between the Arab neighborhoods and the Jewish neighborhoods in Haifa. But generally speaking, I think Palestinians have suffered from institutionalized discrimination, and that is more laws that directly discriminate against them because they were not Jews. Laws and policies that discriminate against them simply because they were not belonging to the majority, starting with laws that were enacted in the early 50s, where the law of return provides automatic citizenship to any Jew who lives anywhere in the world to come into Israel and become a citizen, while Palestinian families separated in the 1948 war cannot do that. They cannot come back to their homeland. They cannot come back to their houses and so forth. The second thing that Israel did and affected the Palestinians in Israel is land policies. They immediately enacted laws that declared many of the Palestinians who resided inside Israel as and their property as absentee property. They declared them as if they are not inside the country in order to confiscate their land. Declared thousands of Palestinian privately owned land as zones where only military forces can go in. And the military regime, you know, continued from 1948 until 1966, where Palestinians within Israel needed permits to travel from Nazareth to Haifa, including my family members, my parents in particular, and other people who lived at this time. And again, if you look at education system, there's a separate educational system, and there are no equality between the two systems.
Tell us a little bit more about that system.
Well, educational system, Israel has like 3-4 educational systems, but the main division is really between Arab and Jewish educational system. And the other subcategories of education system is one for more religious schools, religious Jewish schools that enjoy some kind of autonomy within their schools to set up the curriculum and all that, while Arab schools enjoy no autonomy. It's not a separation based on an understanding that there's differences in language, culture, and so forth, but rather separation that has been a tool to control the Palestinians, to control what Palestinian kids inside Israel learn, what kind of history they learn. I learned more Jewish history than I learned about Arab and Palestinian history. I learned more about the Holocaust, and it's important that I learned about the Holocaust, but I never learned about my Nakba in 1948, for example. Not to mention, of course, inequality in allocation of resources. You have Arab schools and have nothing to give to the students. Just nearby Jewish towns will enjoy more spaces, more recreation facilities,
so
more everything.
So it's akin to what we had for years in the United States on some level, at least the school part of it,
absolutely.
The old separate but unequal.
Absolutely. And people use this example, and we used it in our legal challenges. We said, you know, what we demand is separate but equal, because if we understand that there are good reasons for both for Jews and Arabs to have a separate educational system. But if you want to separate, make sure that you have equality to all.
We are talking with Jamil Dakhwar, who's practiced law both over in Israel. He's a Palestinian slash Israeli, and practiced law over here in the United States. I want to shift our focus from education to land ownership. I understand that in Israel, most of the land is owned by the Jewish National Fund, and that in order to avail yourself of this land, you have to be Jewish. Can you explain to our listeners what that means in terms of people living in Israel, both Arabs and Israelis, with respect to what they can do with the land in Israel?
What Israel did basically in a few years after 1948 was to basically nationalize the lands and resources like land in particular. What they did, they created several entities, including the Land Administration Authority, to run and manage all the lands that were declared as a state land, as a government state land, mainly privately owned property and land that Palestinians owned until 1948. Those Palestinian refugees who would not be allowed to come back. The second part is the largest part, is more of the public domain kind of pieces of land that the British Mandate was holding until 1947.
And that's over 90% of the land in the state
of
Israel, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. In addition to that, they allowed and provided a special status for a pre-1948 Jewish foundations which were founded overseas, like the Jewish Agency, like the National Jewish Fund, to have a special status under Israeli law, both for taxation and for running and managing and using land that the Israeli Lands Authority would lease to them. So basically, you have over 93% of the land in Israel run and managed by Israel's Land Authority, which does not allow leasing lands to Palestinians or Arabs, and only to corporations like Mushavim and kibbutzes and other corporations that will serve the Jewish majority. And as a result of that, what you have Jewish settlements built on privately owned Palestinian land, confiscated and taken from them to the general management of Israel. And as a result, you have villages, Palestinian Arab villages inside Israel, having limited resources to develop, to create a new neighborhood, to have to maintain their agricultural land and so forth, while Israeli settlements expand both in the Galilee and the Naqab in other areas.
Jamil, tell us about the legal definition of apartheid. Does it apply in the territories and does it apply inside of Israel?
First of all, the definition of apartheid is really a system where there's an official policy and a legal regime that separates between people based on race and which creates laws, policies that define or privilege people based on race. And the system in South Africa has been known for this kind of separation, which is a racial separation, which is in violation of international law, which is now became to be realized as a crime under international law. It's actually part of the International Criminal Court and the ICC, the Rome Statute, which was adopted back in 1998. And as a result, people realize that it's a crimes against humanity to put in place a system of apartheid. What people are arguing in the context of Israel is that not necessarily that Israel has become completely state of apartheid, just like South Africa. They are arguing, and I include myself in it, they're arguing that there's a certain areas where there's a clear analogy, where the system of separation on racial basis, differentiating between Arabs and Jews, was put in place by Israel. Whether in the West Bank and Gaza, roads that were built only for the use of settlers, settlements that were used only and built only for Jews, education systems that were only benefiting one group over the other, and so forth. Those segregations, those ones are definitely a form of apartheid. This is a violation of international law. And we think that this is why it's important that people not, you know, think that if you say the word apartheid, that you are basically saying that every single policy that was in South Africa is actually implemented by Israel. I think that it would be foolish to argue this. I think Israel, over the years, have realized that there's a public relations battle and there's an international community and an international opinion that they cannot really put in place such a... In fact, I would argue otherwise. Some people, including people from South Africa, argued that the system in the occupied Palestinian territories, almost 40 years now, of military occupation is even worse than apartheid.
Yeah, we had Jamil Dakwar, human rights attorney. We want to thank you for joining us, and we appreciate your last point. When I was in the territories, I was traveling with a South African, this was about 10 years ago, who said, this is apartheid. And over there, the term is commonly used. So we thank you for coming and shedding light on the issue. Jamil Dakwar, human rights attorney, thanks for joining us on Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.